Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Do squids still use ink, or did they upgrade to touch screens?
Answer me this, answer me this.
How much life have I wasted looking at cat memes?
Answer me this, answer me this. Helen and Ollie, answer me this.
Listeners, pay close attention to this sound.
It's a very special acoustic.
Because this is the last time we're recording this podcast in Martin's and my flat.
It's a very special moment, this, saying farewell to the home studio that has served us so well for, adequately, for 10 years now.
It's a sad moment.
Because, you may recall, Helen and Martin are being kicked out by their landlord because he's moving back from the USA and this is his flat, so you can't live here anymore. What's weird is he's going to move into this flat at which we birthed the show and recorded almost all of the episodes of the show we've ever done.
And basically birthed podcasting in Britain.
Exactly. And he'll be completely oblivious.
Wouldn't even care.
Almost certainly to the significance of this place as the home of South East London podcasting.
And therefore the world's podcasting.
She says modestly.
He'll just walk in and go, where are all the smoke stains I've built up over 15 years of extremely heavy smoking? Why aren't the walls grey anymore? Why doesn't everything stink?
You have done a bit of work here. He might also say, why are there so many hooks for guitars? That's something that he probably didn't think was essential when he left.
He had, on the same wall that the guitar hooks are on, he had a lot of picture hooks with an extension lead decoratively wound around them. It was really tragic.
But anyway, if only he knew. If only he knew the significance that you've achieved here. Instead of moving in himself, he'd hire it out to art historians.
There should be a plaque on this building.
There should. One day there will.
I don't know, it's a listed building, so it might be difficult.
I think they'll make an exception for you.
Better.
I'm going to miss it. I've had some nights here where I've laughed like never before. And,
and also, nights here where you've slept like never before.
Yeah, we are usually on a blow-up mattress, so that is different to other beds.
Yeah, although, but a good Costco blow-up mattress.
It's the best blow-up mattress I've ever slept on, but that's damning with faint praise, I would say.
A lot of people don't even know that it's a blow-up mattress.
It's a good one. I'm not slagging it off.
Costco.
Here's our first question of the show. It's from Tracy in Hockley in Essex, who says, I've just driven to the supermarket and I had to wait quite a while to overtake a group of cyclists. Within the group, there were two people on a tandem. Why, and how can this be better than just having two bikes? I love my husband dearly, but if every time I went out on my bike I had to look at his arse the whole way, it would get very old very quick.
I thought cyclists' arses kept quite tight for longer.
So, Helen, answer me this. Why are tandems still popular?
I don't know if they're popular. I think I maybe see a tandem once every three-ish years.
Yeah, I mean, you live in an increasing... Oh, sorry, lived, past tense. In an increasingly gentrified corner of London, and I hadn't noticed them getting particularly popular around here.
Also, we have a lot of cycle races that start in Crystal Palace and cycle cafes where people are outside stretching their calves and eating protein powder.
And you don't see tandems generally, do you?
But I suppose racing cyclists tend not to go on a tandem. but they are thought to be more energy efficient than two people on two separate bikes.
You presumably got roughly the same aerodynamic drag, haven't you, as you would have with one person, because the profile is roughly the same. I don't know exactly.
Well, and it's more stable as well.
It is more stable.
It's often kids, isn't it? I'm not always, but often it's a parent and a child, and of course the child can't pedal as fast, so they get you know then that they're safe, they're with you, and you're more stable than if the child had their own bike down a hill.
Well, that is also the thing. Although you do need to be in sync with your tandem rider, you don't have to have the same strength, so it is a good one for having a cycle ride with your child where you're not waiting for them endlessly to catch up, or similarly with your ancient parent. But also, if you're cycling with someone who maybe has a disability that stops them from cycling solo, maybe they have vision impairments, they can still cycle.
It's a bit like, in that way, kind of like being the kid sitting on daddy's lap driving the car, isn't it, and pretending to honk the horn.
No, but you do actually have to do something on the back of a bike.
Do you have to, though? Don't your feet just have to go round propelled by the other person if you wanted?
No, you're propelling the pedals in the behind one, you're just not steering.
But if you're on the front one, then you have to steer. So both of them, you have to do something.
Yeah.
You can't just take it easy.
No.
Okay.
So don't let Ollie man on your tandem, because he's just dead weight.
Hello, this is Sean from Stirling. In a takeaway, I just got a can that says not to be sold separately because it's a multi-pack. Why can't you sell them separately?
They can legally be sold separately, Sean. The takeaway that's selling you the can, effectively, that came from a multi-pack, they are just disobeying the manufacturer's advice. And if they don't have a direct contract with the manufacturer, then they're not breaking any law at all because there is no contract to break.
But the can says!
So the reason the can says it is, imagine, Sean, if you weren't in your local takeaway but were instead in your local Sainsbury's. Mm-hmm. Imagine you saw, let's say, Diet Coke on a shelf and they were in a packet of 12. The price per can in a packet of 12 obviously is less than if you go and get a single Diet Coke from a fridge in the same store, right? So Sainsbury's are able to sell the Diet Coke at, I don't know, 65p at the front of the store as a single can, but perhaps 30p at the back because you're buying 12 of them. The unit price is less because you're buying more. So when it says not to be sold separately, it's essentially flagging up, if you were to take that can from the multi-pack and try and buy it in the store, there would be an embarrassing moment where it probably wouldn't scan, and Sainsbury's should properly say, no, you can't buy that because, you know, we're not covering our costs by selling that to you individually. So that's why they do it. Any company that has a direct contract with the manufacturer can't sell those cans separately. But there's actually nothing in law to stop you buying something that's legal and then selling it on at whatever price you want.
Well, this is very disillusioning. I thought those cans were truthful.
Well, there is
just advisory.
There is a possibility of your takeaway getting sued, arguably, if they were selling... I don't think this happens with cans of drink, but with like cans of soup or something... Mm-hmm. Which would be an unlikely thing to get in your takeaway as an additional side order.
Shit, it really was.
But sometimes with things like that, the ingredients label with all the nutritional information for people with allergies and stuff and people who are worried about whether it's kosher or whatever, ooh, that often will only be in the wraparound label, not the individual can. So there is the issue that they're flagging up that this may not contain all the information you need. So, yeah. So you could say, well, my news agent gave me this. It didn't say it contained nuts because it doesn't say that on the individual thing. Yeah. So there's that as well.
And also with some products, like crisps, the multi-pack crisps that are not to be sold separately might be smaller than the soloist packets of crisps.
Aren't they just?
Here's another question of drinks from Danny, who says, I'm having a post-pub kebab, but I have no more beer at home.
Tragic.
Ollie, answer me this. What should I drink? I can find an M&S red wine box, some vintage claret, a 50th birthday present, and some Cointreau.
Okay.
What should I drink?
Definitely not a cocktail.
I think you could have the Cointreau after your kebab.
No, well,
you don't
yes.
want to open with that. That's your nightcap.
Vintage claret, I would say...
Not the time.
No. Save for an opportunity you're going to remember it.
Where your palate has not been corroded by the night you've already had in the pub and the kebab.
Yeah.
Which, whilst kebabs... are wonderful in so many ways, they tend to have a lot of ingredients that will corrupt your palate sensitivity.
Correct. I mean, think back to all those programs you've seen on telly where people are wine tasting. They never say the way to drink this is to make sure
half a raw onion first, yeah, and a lot of jalapenos.
First, make sure your taste buds are obliterated by chili mayonnaise. They never say that, and there's a reason for that. So save the posh wine. So then we're down to the M&S wine box. Now I think you're in a lucky situation here,
yeah,
because red wine, I think, is a good pre-sleep drink anyway, so long as you stick with it and don't mix it with other stuff.
Yeah.
And it's a pleasant and a slow alcoholic hit.
And it works with the beer before wine fine.
Yes, exactly.
Wine before beer fear.
So, yeah, I'd say the red wine box is a good option. It is also, being Marks and Spencer's, not going to be terrible wine. Like, their bottom standard, even if it's the cheapest one, and it will be if it's in a box, but even if it's the cheapest one at M&S, that's going to be a lot better than the cheapest one at Asda.
And also, you've just ate a kebab. Will you actually be aware of whatever you're drinking if you just have water? Will you even notice?
Well, that's probably what you should have, yeah.
Because it's very salty.
Although I find myself often drinking red wine, rum as well, dark rum, late at night.
Okay.
A shot of dark rum with no mixer.
Just
don't know
what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Do you need us to call someone?
Are you a sailor?
I've got a question.
Email your question to answermethispodcast@googlemail.com.
To answer me this podcast at googlemail.com.
To answer me this podcast at googlemail.com.
To answer me this podcast at googlemail.com.
Here's a question from Peter in Haywards Heath, who says, I'm currently listening to an episode of The Archers. That's an aid memoir for anyone who's too young to actually listen to The Archers but knows Radio 4 vaguely from hearing it in their parents' house.
It's just that strong sense memory.
Do you know, I was once a guest on Front Row, and just before the show starts, the producer said into Mark Lawson, the presenter's ear, he said, do you want to do a rehearsal of the opening menu? And Mark Lawson actually said in his own mic out loud 5 minutes before the real show started, he said, okay, that was the Archers, and now front row, hello, good evening. He did the rehearsal because he had to sing the Archers to himself.
He had to get into character.
That's amazing. Like, that's how much of a cue it is, even for people that bloody work there.
Imagine what it's like being in the Archers.
Yeah, incredible.
They probably all do that.
Like Peter says, he is currently listening to an episode of the Archers. And it got me thinking, he says, about their scripts and recording processes.
Was the plot not very absorbing? Yeah,
it was probably something about udders. Helen, answer me this. How many episodes of The Archers do they record in a day?
4.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
That's a lot of episodes, isn't it?
Yeah, but they only have 8 recordings a month. So right. For a daily show, that works well.
So it's like the daily quiz shows that they bang out like Pointless.
Yeah.
And how far in advance of broadcast do they record them?
1 month. I got this information from a friend of a friend who is in the Archers.
Oh, wow. Wow.
Yeah.
The only time I've ever encountered the Archers is when waiting for front row to start. And I don't have anything against it, like you do with all radio drama. I don't have anything theoretical
so
against
much
it.
Sighing.
I would one day be ready for the Archers, but I feel like...
You live in the country already. You could be ready for the Archers.
I feel like it's going to be the same time in my life when I'm ready for classical music, which is when my libido dies.
Okay. So the only thing keeping your libido alive is not listening to the Archers. Yeah. Are you worried?
It's 7 o'clock. It's Mark Forrest. Gives me a right old stiffy. There's no way I could possibly listen to the Archers.
I've got a mental image of your flaccid penis gradually falling onto the radio dial and knocking it onto classic FM now.
And you're like, well, I guess it's time.
It's time. Da, 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 da.
So I heard somewhere that the Archers originally, and maybe still does, has like an informational component, like it's meant to inform farmers about matters of countryside business. Is that right?
Yeah, that is right. It does have its origins in proper Reithian principles, yeah. The original producer of the Archers, Godfrey Basely, his name was, had previously worked not on soaps but on agricultural programmes. And his concept was, this is boring. If we dress this up so that there's a bit of drama in it, you know, once every 6 weeks someone dies or whatever, then farmers would be more likely to listen to the stories and pick up the messages along the way.
I wonder if that worked.
It's amazing.
Well, the show's still running, so something worked.
Yeah, but I wonder whether it has shifted from that original principle. Because I don't listen, I couldn't possibly say.
I think, I can't remember the exact year, but something like 1972... they abandoned any commitment to educate in the show and it became a straight up drama.
Right.
But now, still, it reflects farming issues like when foot and mouth happened.
Yeah.
Although farmers wouldn't listen to that to get advice on what to do with their cattle, like his idea was, we've got rationing, so this will tell farmers how to feed the nation. Now, you're unlikely to learn lessons, but you are still, I think, likely to think, okay, this is reflecting my real life. I'm more likely to listen and feel like part of a community through this.
What if they think it's real?
Do you think this is what will happen to the Beef and Dairy Network?
Oh, I think a lot of people who first listened to Beef and Dairy Network, podcast by friend of the show, Benjamin Partridge, who way back in the first year of the show, I think, sent us a question asking if he should go to Bremen on holiday, and they made a package in Bremen on holiday.
To answer me this store.com if you'd like to hear it.
Yeah, and since then I've got to know him in real life. He has a podcast now, very funny, called Beef and Dairy Network. But I think a lot of people that I've seen on Twitter were like, oh, it's fiction. Ah.
What makes me laugh about the Archers is when you look through the list of cameos, celebrities who have appeared in it as themselves.
Yeah.
I mean, like, Judy Dench has done it as an actress and stuff, but like, if you look at who's actually appeared as themselves, quite eclectic, as you'd expect with a long-running soap like that. So Chris Moyles has been in it, propping up the bar.
I'm not surprised. He's in the same building as the BBC.
Exactly.
Prince.
Prince wasn't. Pet Shop Boys did do it, just like they did in Neighbours.
Of course, yeah.
They did.
Yeah. And there was an episode with Griff Rhys-Jones, apparently, where...
That's not a surprise.
No, exactly. I'm getting to my point. The episode with Griff Rhys-Jones, again, expected. He went along to one of the fictional characters who was trying to sell off the pub or something, and he tried to restore the building for his TV programme Restoration. That was the plot line. So,
right.
So, you sort of understand those celebrity cameos. Then I found that in 2007, Lord Winston did a cameo as himself, as a fertility specialist, when a couple in the show who had fertility problems went to go and see the actual Lord Winston, and he advised them on whether or not they should have treatment.
Wow. But hang on. That must have been really expensive.
What, for them to record?
for those characters
to
the top fertility specialist.
Presumably that's partly the drama of it. But doesn't it sort of cheapen the whole thing, bearing in mind they are fictional characters? It both cheapens the... the actual process of going to see the top fertility expert and also the soap itself by having a real life person rather than an actor playing them.
I don't know that it cheapens it so much as really rips you out of the fact that it's made up. It just draws attention to the fact that the rest is made up.
It's an awkward celebrity cameo as well, because it's like, look at the clever thing I do. I get to help couples have children sometimes. Sometimes the babies don't make it through. It's just a bit weird.
Since he does have a service to sell, does that make that episode of The Archers branded content?
Exactly. Does it make it advertising? Yeah.
Complicated. Now it's time for today's intermission.
Hurrah!
Where we take a little snippet from an Answer Me This episode from the past.
Yes, just a little amuse-bouche.
Yes.
Just something to tantalise your taste buds. It's by no means the whole thing.
But you could go totally La Grande Bouffe by buying episodes 1 to 200 from our website,
answermethisstore.com.
We've had this in from Vicky, age 15, in Oxted. She has just watched the film Lolita online. I was in floods of tears at the tragic and powerful end. Hold on. She's going to ruin the ending now.
It's all right. We've passed the statute of limitations on spoilers.
She's about to ruin one of the greatest pieces of literature of all time.
Published in 1955.
Yes. Fine. She says the ending of the film she saw was a caption on the screen that says they both die. What kind of a shitty ending is that? I think I've lost all my innocence forever.
Well, you were watching Lolita online, which is A, stealing, B, a film about paedophilia, so innocence be gone.
To be fair, you never really imagined that the ending would suddenly be a marriage and a sing-along, would you? I mean, I've not read the book.
We're all in this together.
I've not read the book, but I guessed it would probably be a bit tragic.
It's time, listeners, to remind you that if you want to leave a question on our voicemail, then you can call in on the following number. 4, 2, 3, 5, 7. Oh, did that sound different to usual, did it? That's because there's a little present from Tom from Pennsylvania.
Yeah, it's a jingle that he's made of our phone number, which, by the way, if you missed it, is 0208-123-5877. The numbers made up by bits of famous artists singing songs from their back catalogue. Did you spot all the songs there?
Even spot the numbers.
Well, it's quite hard to make out the number. But we'll put the list of all the songs on our website. Bill Withers was in there. Meatloaf was in there, which, you know, obviously is exciting to me.
Yeah.
And a song by Prince called Seven.
I was not familiar with that Prince number.
No. I'm trying to think if there's a more famous song with the word seven in it.
There's 7 Seconds by Yusu Endor and Nana Cherry.
Yeah, that is a better one. I think what we're doing is saying that you could have done this better, Tom.
But don't do it again, because we can't pay copyrighted music fees. It's very complicated, the licensing, in every country that this podcast is available in, which is nearly all of them. Anyway, let's hear who has been in touch today.
Hi, Helen, Ollie. It's Sean from Bury here. I've been all over America. I've had American food from all the different states, well, nearly all of them, but I've never had Native American food. So answer me this. What is traditional Native American cuisine? And secondly, why is it not popular in restaurants? Why has there been no Native American food franchise outlet? Is this a gold mine that we're sitting on?
Gold mine we're sitting on. Yeah, let's take something that's theirs and exploit it for capitalist gain, because that always goes so well when it comes to Native American culture. People really love that. It gets very positive press, doesn't it?
I have my thoughts about why this hasn't caught on as a cuisine in the States. But first of all, do you know what Native American cuisine is? Because as Native peoples, quite widely geographically spread.
Absolutely. And the local ingredients around which Native American food is based vary wildly from Alaska to the southeastern US.
Yeah.
But I've travelled very extensively in the lower 48. Didn't really encounter that much Native American food. The only time I have really come across any was in Arizona and New Mexico.
And what was it there?
So there, the feature I particularly remember was fry bread, which is like a massive bit of fried dough. And also corn and squashes, peppers and tomatoes in some places. Like in some places they'll have a lot of game, in others they'll have more fish depending on the geography. Like in Alaska they have more seal meat than they have in Arizona.
But it's also the bits of the animal that they eat are different. There's a lot of brain going on in Native American cuisine, I understand.
Liver and stuff. And then berries. So I think it does have the capacity to become very popular with people who are into the paleo diet or similar, and they want these ancient, unrefined ingredients because they don't really use farm meat traditionally. They don't use processed flour and sugar.
And I presume there's a lot of overlap in the South with Mexico because those peoples kind of were permeated and migratory and traded and communicated and so on.
Yeah, so I remember when we were served fry bread, it was very much in the style that you might be served a taco, so with salsa and sour cream and beanie things dumped on it.
Well, I think in that lies my answer as to why this isn't as popular in the US as pizza joints and Mexican and all the rest of it. I mean, there's lots of reasons. One of them is what you were hinting at, the different geographical areas. So people in one place would go in expecting salmon and another place expecting buffalo. So how do you have a consistent meal that you offer up as a cuisine? But I think the real issue actually is the cost. So if you imagine a taco and you get cheap pork to put in it if you've got a Mexican restaurant, if you're running a Native American restaurant, imagine the controversy of an American company like McDonald's opening up branches of Native American cuisine that didn't employ Native Americans, right? That would be a no-go. They'd have to say, we use genuine ingredients farmed by Native Americans. That costs loads of money. If you're going to have a buffalo brought up and slaughtered by people who are not exactly in tune with intensive farming, that's going to create its own issue. And the general pundit isn't prepared to spend four times as much for a buffalo taco as for a pork taco. And that's basically what it comes down to.
I think that is some of what it might come down to, but far from the whole story. I think you've got a very complex issue. As soon as you get into there being large chains of Native American restaurants, which will be largely serving people who are not Native Americans, then you open up that very complicated and politically sensitive situation. Because Native Americans have been fucked over such a lot and discriminated against a lot and marginalised a lot and culturally appropriated a lot. And this would probably happen again. Like, if it was difficult for Native Americans to set up these large businesses because their income is way below average, so it's hard to set up a massive chain, the settlements they were given are not usually near the big cities where food trends start. And then if you're based around local ingredients, how are you going to get them in New York, say, where the trend would then spread to other places? And then what do you do to attract outsiders? Because a lot of people are not curious or brave about trying new foods. Do you then compromise your traditional foods to attract them? And then if they are restaurants not run by Native Americans, then you get the whole culturally insensitive,
but
diluting their
culture. You could imagine a group of people from Arizona or New Mexico setting up a chain in LA and it being very popular, right?
Well, they have.
There's one in New York at the moment.
Well, this is
one.
It. They often say in their interviews, like, you know, we're going to open a chain of 12 restaurants by the end of the year, and the biggest chain at the moment has two. So it hasn't proven itself as a business model. It's partly because landlords don't want to take the risk either, because they know there's an audience for burgers. They can't prove there's one for Native American food.
But also Native Americans apparently don't have a restaurant culture, which I think would influence it as well. But I wouldn't be surprised if in the next few years it does take off.
Would you eat bird brain soup, though, if I served it up to you now and told you it was delicious?
Don't really like soup.
Don't avoid the issue.
Bird
brains.
Brain.
Would you eat bird brain soup?
I think it would depend on the texture of the brains, often with organs.
Well, would it?
I find
it's
the
off the
texture
menu.
Difficult.
Off the menu. Here you are. You're in my Native American restaurant. I say this is a great recipe handed down from my grandparents. You know, it's got a Michelin star, this place. It's culturally right on. Everyone's Native American. Would you eat my bird brain soup or not?
Was I ordering it, or were you just shoving it in front of me?
I'm the waiter, and I've come up to you, and I've chatted you up, and I've been like, our specials of the day are this and this.
No, never order the specials. The specials is always stuff they're trying to get rid of.
Okay, I think she's avoiding the question.
I think she is. Yeah.
Would you eat bird brain soup? That's
Would you?
If I was in someone's house, then I would. If I was ordering in a restaurant, then
okay,
I wouldn't.
Fine.
I wouldn't eat it in a different culture either. I just don't really like offal.
No, neither do I, but it's a big part of certain Native American cuisines, that's all I'm saying.
I've definitely eaten stuff that I thought would be disgusting and found delicious. Like, I remember eating Polish tripe soup that was amazing.
You've just got to sort of close your eyes and pretend you don't know what it is, haven't you?
Hello. I'm Wilson, the ball from Castaway, and here is my song about my favourite balls. Football, rugby ball, volleyball ball, tennis ball, Zoe ball, basketball, netball, handball, debutante ball, bowling ball, baseball, big sweaty ball.
Answer Me This Sports Day, a marathon of fun and games, out now at answermethispodcast.com/albums.
Here's a question from Adam from Yorkshire, who says, Helen, answer me this. When you leave a fingerprint at a crime scene, what are you actually leaving behind? What is it on your finger that's coming off and staying on a surface until someone wipes it down?
Is it oil?
Yeah, it can be oil from your finger or sweat or dirt, or if you had traces of, say, engine oil on your finger, you might leave that.
If you just washed your hands with soap and water, you could still leave fingerprints, though, couldn't
you?
What's that?
Well, I think that will still be oil. There's also the option where you leave fingerprints in something say, powdery or squidgy, so you leave an impression of your fingerprint rather than the actual substances of your finger.
Mm-hmm.
But I think he's asking about the muck you leave, the human muck.
The fact they still use fingerprints and that's what Sherlock Holmes was using is sort of extraordinary, isn't it?
Still works. People have still got unique fingerprints.
I think racist eugenicist statistician Francis Galton figured out the likelihood of two people having the same fingerprints. And I think it was something like 1 in 70 billion.
Wow.
Which is why it's thought... I think that there's been evidence to say that's not quite true. But that's why it was thought to be such a good indicator of guilt if you find someone's fingerprints.
It's also quite hard to fake, isn't it?
It's a lot of effort, yeah.
How would you plant someone's fingerprint in a place that they'd never been to? Obviously, if they lived there.
You could do it with sellotape now, pretty easily, couldn't you? A bit of dust and then off a wine glass, I guess.
Yeah, we've all seen that bullshit in murder mysteries on telly, right?
Yeah,
do people actually do it?
I mean, if you're pinning your whole deception on it, bit of sellotape on the back of a wine glass.
Well, you'd be better off doing DNA evidence then.
Yes, exactly, nowadays.
But I think there's far more problems with DNA evidence. I think that gets compromised a lot more often than fingerprint evidence.
Best thing, obviously, to wank someone off in their sleep and then plant that around the house, but it's difficult to...
The burglar seems to have jizzed everywhere. That'd be an amazing Miss Marple.
Rick says, Helen, answer me this. Are there any health benefits to oil pulling? I've read that swishing coconut oil around in your mouth for up to 20 minutes and then spitting it out into the trash, otherwise it clogs your sink's drain pipes when it solidifies again.
Good point, Rick.
Thanks for the tip, Rick. Will remove toxins that form in your mouth.
Oh, you've always got to be so careful around things that claim to remove toxins. Firstly, you should ask the practitioners what they mean by that.
Yes, by toxins.
By toxins.
It's like when people say they've got a great energy or they're very spiritual.
But toxins are actually a thing. Like heavy metals, those are toxic.
Yeah.
Whereas what they're talking about, they're usually more vague when you press them on it. And also, if you're a fairly healthy person in that all of your organs are working and you're not absolutely barraging them with terrible substances, they will eliminate toxins from your body for you. That is what your liver and kidneys and digestive system are for.
Glad to hear it.
Your kidneys have put them into piss, basically, won't they?
But coconut oil is the current panacea of Paltrow choice.
I think it's even overtaken cider vinegar.
Yeah.
And bicarbonate of soda.
So why is that?
Well, coconut oil has antibacterial properties. It is 50% lauric acid, which inhibits strep mutans that are the primary bacteria that cause tooth decay. So it may help prevent tooth decay. Also, there's some bacteria that will bond to fatty substances, and thus it's easier to wash them out of your mouth with an oil.
That's sensible.
Yes, but it's one of those things where it's probably not bad for you. Well, it's probably not bad for you, but the thing is, if you get coconut oil into your lungs, then it can cause lipoid pneumonia. So actually, it can be a bit bad for
you. But that would be true of any oil that you inhaled.
Yeah, and also it can give people stomach upsets. But the thing is, like, they're saying, yes, it could be good for like strengthening your jaw and whitening your teeth and freshening your breath, but not necessarily, in the limited studies that have been done, better than a mouthwash. But I suppose you might want to avoid the chemicals that are in a mouthwash.
I've been buying coconut oil for 6 months now, and I didn't know you were supposed to use it in your mouth.
I've tried it a couple of times just to see what this is like.
Have you?
Yeah.
You didn't tell me that.
Well, I don't tell you everything.
Keeping the secrets.
Well, how do you... Because I've been using it for cooking.
Yeah.
Is that wrong?
No, it's meant to be very good.
Oh, you can use it for cooking?
Oh, you can use it for every bloody thing now.
But it's okay to eat it?
Yeah, but I used it also on a scar that was reluctant to heal.
Wow.
Really cleared it up.
It really is the panacea of the moment.
Yeah.
Is it liquid coconut?
No, it's a mushy cream. How do you swill it?
Well, some people just put a lump in their mouth and swill it until it liquefies. I put a little bit into a cup that was in some warm water, so it melted into a liquid.
Uh-huh.
And then you just sort of sit sloshing it around your mouth, and it turns white, and everyone's like, oh, that means it's filling with toxins. But it's filling with saliva and air, which means, of course, it's changing. There have been a few studies done, but they are by people who are affiliated with Ayurvedic medicine, which has been using oil pulling for like 3,000 to 5,000 years. Therefore, they're not necessarily the most impartial or the most accurate. So you probably shouldn't start at 20 minutes a day. That will be too much. You can start with 5 minutes and work up if you really want to do this. And then you're supposed to rinse your mouth out with salt water. So if the coconut oil didn't make you puke, salt water will do it for you.
I'm an Answer Me This fan. I listen with my nan. She is not so keen. She finds it too obscene. I follow them on Twitter, though Ashton Kutcher's fitter. I want to take things further, just one step short of murder. I want to look like Ollie Man. I want to smell like Ollie Man. I want to be like Ollie Man. I want to chase like Ollie Man. I want to look like Ollie Man.
Here's a question from an anonymous lady who says, I'm in my 20s. My younger brother is at university, he's in his late teens, and during the holidays, he lives with our mum. This week, he revealed he's been reading her diary.
What?
And has relayed to me some increasingly juicy, scandalous, and now quite concerning elements of what seems to be her sexual reawakening since getting divorced.
Good God. You know, when I was a teenager, I did go digging around into my dad's porn collection because I knew it was there and it was my only chance to encounter anything like that. If I'd have stumbled onto anything homemade, I would have had to have blinded myself. I took that risk knowingly.
That's what happens in Oedipus, isn't it?
The idea of reading the innermost thoughts of my parents that are meant to be private, you know, even if they're just words on a page, if they're sexually explicit, that is absolute poison, isn't it?
And also, when you're younger, it's so inconceivable that they're actually human beings with urges and lives of their own. That they're just subsets of you.
Yeah, and I just think it would be playing on your mind all the time. If you're still the child in that relationship, and this sounds like it's slightly easier for her in her 20s not living with her mum anymore to talk about. For her brother, you know, he's living with her, she's the mum figure still. I think this is quite disturbing stuff.
Well, anonymous lady says, I've told him to stop reading the diary, but Ollie, answer me this. What do I do with the knowledge I've acquired?
Hire the Men in Black.
It sounds like she is engaging in risky and unpleasant to her sexual antics with equally unpleasant men.
What? Just put your fingers in your ears and say la la la. Is that really so difficult?
I think she wants her mother not to be having sexual encounters that are emotionally or physically damaging to her.
Yeah, but then her mother can come to her and ask for advice, can't she?
I think the what she may be hinting at is a difference in generational attitudes towards sex.
Possibly, but then possibly her mother's also interested in someone else of the same age as her, and that person's from that generation as well. And why should a younger person assume that they know all what a good relationship is when the older person's been in one for longer?
Well, I think anonymous lady can interpret whether it's risky, and that could still mean her mum's having a good time. But if she's saying it's unpleasant to her mum, that sounds like the mum must have been confided in the diary that really make her very happy for whatever reason. Anonymous lady says, I don't want to let my mum know that her children have been reading her diary, although she certainly invaded my privacy a great deal during my teens, but I'm very concerned about what she appears to have become involved in. She's not the most assertive of people, and she's also, I think, incredibly naive, thanks to a 30-plus year marriage. I don't think she knows what a good relationship or good sex should be like.
She's taking a very, like, paternalistic attitude towards her mum, isn't she? Like, is she worried that, like, she's in physical danger? Is she worried about, like, safe sex? Like, what are her concerns? Either way, I think she's being the mum in this relationship, isn't she?
The other Freudian thing here, I don't know the circumstances of your parents' divorce, obviously, but it sounds like some of your concern, you've got to confront the fact that your mother is having sex with someone, and that will sometimes, you know, be something she enjoys and sometimes not. And actually, sometimes those two things happen together, and we're all programmed not to think about that. We're all programmed to think of our parents as our parents from the moment we're born if we're brought up in conventional setups.
But also, without knowing the specifics of whether it is destructive sexual and emotional behaviour that her mother's engaged with, it could just be that your mother's back on the market, and when you're dating, you might have some encounters that you just think that person is a bit of a twat. Like, it might not be a harmful thing to do. You might just be like, well, I'm out there. Doesn't mean everyone is someone I'm really pleased to be with.
No, exactly. And actually, the fact that she is confiding it to her diary, I haven't kept a diary since I was 12, but when I did, there was definitely an element in there of bragging to the future me. I mean, obviously hopelessly, but I didn't know that at the time, about what I'd done. And even when I was angry about stuff, even when I was unhappy with the way things were going, it was really a way of me recording a thing that on some level I thought was quite cool had happened to me. I mean, your mum might just essentially, by writing these detailed descriptions of unpleasant men she's having sex with, effectively be saying to her future self, I'm having sex!
Yeah?
I'm having sex!
Or if later, when you're no longer seeing these people and you're feeling a bit nostalgic about it and thinking, oh my God, they were the one.
Yeah.
You can look back at this and think, it was just a bit of a tool.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. The signs were all there. I just didn't want to believe it. But anyway, I don't think really you should mention to your mum that you read her diary.
But you could engage her in a conversation where you got a bit more earnest about her dating life.
You could
say, how has it been going on the single scene? Have you met anyone nice? What's it like dating after 30 years of divorce? I think you can just come out and say that, can't
you? Use it as briefing notes.
Yeah, but
don't let her know where you're getting it from.
No, and then if your mother seems like there's something troubling her, you could gently steer her towards talking about that. And she doesn't necessarily have to reveal to you in person the particulars of her sex life. But if then you have concerns that she's engaging in, let's say, unequal encounters, whether they are harmful or not, then you can talk about them. Right?
Also, she's presumably hearing about it from her brother, not reading the extracts herself.
Not clear, again. Yeah. Not clear.
So maybe he's interpreting it slightly.
And he might have less of an understanding of the sexual urges of a woman who is several decades his senior.
Exactly. You could be hearing a teenage boy's interpretation of a middle-aged woman's sexual frustrations.
Not ideal.
But not the clearest picture.
Mm.
But it sounds like a great idea for a podcast.
My mum wrote a diary. Straight to number one, people.
Sadly, that particular one isn't available right now. But our archive is, a reminder, on our website, answermethisstore.com. And there'll be new episodes of this show very soon with your questions,
which you can supply using the contact details on our website,
answermethispodcast.com.
And also, if you need more ear matter, then you can use our offer to get a free audiobook from Audible by going to answermethispodcast.com/audible.
That's right. Remember, if you get a free audiobook, it doesn't cost you anything. That's the meaning of the word free. But we get money from Audible. So thanks.
Mm. Listeners, I'm doing a live show of The Allusionist in September on the 24th at the London Podcast Festival. So come along to that at King's Place.
Am I doing something for that?
I reckon I'll get Martin on stage to do something.
I can do a little dance.
Oh, Martin, you're trying to live negotiate your role here.
I'm appearing as the letter A.
Are you going anyway, but you haven't got anything?
I'm just going to storm the stage with my guitar.
Okay.
So maybe I can see you in person then. But before that, please join us again in 2 weeks for the next Answer Me This.
Bye! If you're in business, you probably have a website, but can your site handle your growth? How many visitors before your site slows down or crashes? What about storage and data security? From web hosting to virtual servers, Pear Networks provides the online infrastructure you need to start, grow, and flourish. When it comes to security and updates, don't worry, we've got you covered. Our 24/7 US-based customer support is the best in the industry. No frustrating chatbots or sitting on hold for hours. Check out pair.com today to learn more. That's PAIR.com.